It's Bill Leff, and it's Jane Manzouris. She is sitting in for Wendy Snyder, who will be back on Monday. And one of our favorite guests has joined us in studio, Lucianne Walkowitz, astrophysicist at the Adler Planetarium, TED speaker, artist, guitarist for Ditch Club, and even though you're tired of it, I will never be tired of it, 13th sexiest scientist in the world or in the United States?
In Business Insider magazine, your go-to source for
for all things sexy and science.
For superficial qualities of scientists.
My Christmas dream, Lucianne, is that this year they reevaluate that list and that you crack the top 10. That is my Christmas dream.
That is a fine dream for you to have.
Thank you.
That's a great accomplishment.
Yep. Yeah.
Did you get your picture in there and everything?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you have to dress sexy or just your, you know, just because
no.
It is the most sexiest?
No, yep. They just asked me for a picture, and I was like, "Here, this is not terrible."
Did any scientist said, "Hey, I'm in this because I love science.
Yeah.
I won't play that game." Did any of them do that, or were any of them like, "Wow, I made the top 100. This is great."
Actually, I think a lot of people were not pleased with that article.
Really?
Because it is superficial, and mm-hmm. it's lauding scientists for something that has like nothing to do with
right.
their science. Babak Ferdowsi, who's the better known as NASA Mohawk guy, who was the guy on the Curiosity rover.
Oh,
team.
Yeah. I know who that is. Yeah.
So he's a friend of mine. He's number one. And I texted him and I was like, "What's up, number one?" And he was like, "I'm not a scientist. I'm an engineer."
Oh.
So
take me off the list.
Yeah.
Where was Bill Nye on the list? Did Bill Nye make the top 100?
I don't know.
No.
Yeah.
I find him very sexy.
Does it come out every year? This is great. I never knew that there was a top 100 sexiest.
I don't know that it
scientist.
Does. Does it?
I think they were just maybe scrambling. Slow news day, I guess.
Oh, maybe. It's still an honor.
Did you get mad at the person that nominated you? You're like, "What are you doing?"
You can't get mad. It's a high honor. Is Buzz Aldrin okay?
Yep, Buzz is doing a lot better, as some of your listeners maybe heard, and I know you both heard this. Buzz was down at the South Pole,
mm-hmm.
Which is like, I guess, the second coolest place you can go after mm-hmm. you've been to the moon.
Yeah.
You know, maybe. Probably the second most remote place you could go.
Probably.
So he was down there touring and was feeling not really good. You know, as we were talking about, you're allowed to have a couple bad days when you're 86 and you've
yeah.
been to space. So he's back in New Zealand, actually, doing his recovery. And he posted some pictures of himself giving the thumbs up. And he looks
back
hale and hearty.
That's good.
But yeah, he had to leave. You know, Antarctica is not the greatest place to get sick.
Probably not.
Yeah. You don't know what the hospital is going to be like.
Mm-mm.
Probably being home is better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Have you ever talked to him, Lucianne?
Buzz
Aldrin?
I have, no.
We've had him on the show a couple times. And the first time we had him on, he seemed to have a great sense of humor about everything. You know, we talked to him about being on The Simpsons and a couple of other things. He had a great sense of humor. The second time, not quite as much.
How many of your jokes did you tell him?
probably about several more than I should have, probably. Do you think that might have added to his disposition, do you think, maybe? Just a little bit. But he is, like, when you think about the early days, those early Apollo astronauts, is he the last survivor, or are there a couple more? I'm trying to think. Thomas Collins is still around, isn't he?
Yeah, Mike Collins.
Mike Collins, I'm sorry.
Still around.
Tom Collins is a drink,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, Tom Collins is a drink. Mike
sorry.
Collins.
It's Friday, you're fine.
Right.
Lives in Italy, where he perhaps has a Tom Collins from time to time.
Right.
But yeah, I believe he's still alive, and explaining in Italian that he did not actually leave the spacecraft.
Right, he stayed inside.
Yeah, I mean, somebody's got to do it.
And Mike
right?
Collins was
and
the guy.
But don't you think once you're already up there, you want to get out?
I mean, yes.
You take
the
trip.
You're all the way there. You don't just stay on the boat or stay on the plane.
Well, but somebody has to. Like, you can't just...
Right.
Can you trade spots? Like, let me go first and then we'll switch and then I can get out there.
I think if our landing technologies at that point were a little better and, mm-hmm. You know, you could take more of a taxi back and forth to the moon. That would have been one thing. But, you know,
right.
remember, this was the first time it ever happened. And so
yeah,
even getting back to the orbiter was like not a necessarily.
It's a huge thing,
yeah.
right?
So
do you know who his daughter now in that first moon landing, you had the big three. You had Buzz Aldrin, you had Armstrong, and then you had Collins. Do you know who his daughter is?
No, actually.
His daughter, Kate Collins, played Natalie on All My Children for, I think, 9 years.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Isn't that cool?
Wow, fancy family best, right there.
Isn't that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A bunch of underachievers.
Can I ask a question? I just heard this yesterday, and this may or may not be true, but I've heard that medical scientists have now found out that when the astronauts go on the moon, when they go that far out of, you know, into outer space, their eye sockets and their eyeballs swell. And they just found this out, and they said, we figured out why. It's because the spinal fluid is not able to move freely because of gravity.
Yeah, so it's actually not with going to the moon. It's the astronauts that go and live up on the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here on Earth, we evolved as creatures to have all these signals about, like, posture changes. You
sure.
know, like, the effect of gravity here on Earth has caused us to work in a particular way. And so, you know, when you sit up or lie down or, you know, tilt to the side, your body kind of knows how you're pointed and yeah. gravity yeah. is acting on those fluids in your body differently. So one of the things that has been noticed over the past several years by actually a physician who was an astronaut as well, who was up in the International Space Station, started to notice that he couldn't read the listings, like the chore list, I think it was, because mm-hmm. it's in like 8-point font, which I frankly have trouble reading
sure.
here in Earth's gravity. So the International Space Station is orbiting, which means it's in free fall. So they're in what we call a microgravity environment. So there's gravity, but they're not experiencing the same kind of
yeah.
that we have here.
Yeah.
They've now done a bunch of follow-up studies because what they find is that there is this buildup of fluid, and they're not really sure why. But there's this buildup of fluid that affects like the optic nerve and causes some distortions, basically astigmatism in mm-hmm. The shape of your eyeball.
Mm.
And, you know, there are a number of different physiological changes that happen to astronauts when they go to space. Like one of the big ones that's been known for a long time is that most astronauts come back with mild osteoporosis.
They do.
Because you're, again, used to, you know, the impacts
gravity,
of being
yeah.
gravity, and so you lose bone density. And so you can have very young,
wow.
hale and hearty people breaking a hip when they
right.
get back if they're not careful. And that actually can be turned around and remediated by taking, like, calcium supplements and
yeah.
stuff like that. And once you're back in Earth's gravity for a while, you know, that goes away, but the eyesight changes don't. And so they're very concerned about this because that's, you know, a couple months to a year of living on the International Space Station. If you mm-hmm. want to send people further into space to Mars or whatever, you're going to have to understand how you can work against that because you don't want people to go
right.
severely blind while
right.
they're there.
Because we don't have anything that's pumping the spinal cord fluid, just but our movements do it, whereas our blood is being pumped by our heart.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's, you know, that actually works because we're getting it pumped. But the spinal cord fluid, that's an interesting thing. I just
yeah.
read it. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. But doesn't this play into the study that they did with the twins where they sent one twin into space? This just
mm-hmm.
happened a year or so ago. One
yeah.
twin is up in space and they keep one on Earth and they just wanted to see how the bodies were different with those circumstances, huh?
Yeah. Speaking of underachieving families, the
yeah.
two twins that are in the astronaut program.
Yeah. Mary-Kate and Ashley.
Right, exactly. One of them indeed stayed on Earth and one lived up for a year on the International Space Station. They wanted to compare the two of them. The hard thing is that it's really, it's hard to study some of these effects because you have very small numbers. So you have a problem which we call small number statistics.
Yeah,
where
right.
you sometimes don't know, you know, if you only have like a handful of people, you don't know whether there's differences between those people that cause them to be affected in a particular way.
Sure.
Or whether that's just something that happens to everybody. And that makes it difficult to understand how to work against it, you know,
yeah.
how to like make it better for those astronauts.
So the yeah. answer, the easy answer is we need a lot more twins
yes.
entering into the space program.
Yes.
Yeah. Please, twins, listening.
The doublemint twin
right,
auditions. We'll take the girls that don't get picked and
yes.
the guys. We'll take yep. the twins that aren't
we
in the
We want all of them.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a quick break and then more of this sort of behavior. We're at 312-981-7200. Call us or text us back after this. It's Bill and Jane in for Wendy on WGN. Bill Left, Jane Manzouris filling in for Wendy Snyder. She'll be back on Monday, a scheduled day off. Lucianne Walkowitz is in studio with us, astrophysicist over at the Adler Planetarium, TED speaker, artist, guitarist for Ditch Club. Is Ditch Club playing anytime soon, Lucianne? Can people see them over the holidays?
Not over the holidays. We're taking a little bit of time off to record. So,
are you?
Stay
That's
tuned.
Cool.
We'll have
Excellent.
Another EP out. Sometime.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Here's a big story from science that was in the news, from astronomy. They have found a large ice sheet on Mars. What exactly does this mean? This is good news, right? This means a possible step toward life on Mars,
yeah.
right?
Well, yeah, possibly. So, you know, certainly we know that Mars was probably a warmer, friendlier, cuddlier planet in the past. We think that it had global oceans at one point, and yeah. nowadays it's pretty barren and pretty pretty dry overall. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the search for life in the universe, we're always looking for water as a place that, you know, we find life thriving here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, what we're usually looking for is liquid water, it is true that we have people that study life, potential life in ice. So the way that this ice sheet was found was with the MRO, which stands for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It goes around the planet and it uses essentially ice penetrating radar, which is the same way that we study ice here on our own planet. So just a couple months ago, we had a scientist called Brittany Schmidt, who works on potential life on Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter. And she does this by flying a World War II era plane with ice penetrating radar over Antarctica and uses that to probe like where there might be, you know, melty water within the ice sheet. And then, you know, like drops, like basically goes ice fishing with very fancy science robots that study like life below and within the ice. And so in the case of this ice sheet that's on Mars, they used a very similar method to probe this one area of Mars that had this sort of like scalloped appearance.
Yeah.
So it all, you know, much like, you know, like snert, like the dirty snow that happens here late in the season in Chicago.
Yeah. I've never heard that.
Well, it just sort of looks like dirt, right?
Yeah.
No, it's snow.
Yeah.
So when you look at Mars, it doesn't look like a big, like nice white ice sheet because a lot of Mars has this red dust. Mm-hmm. So they looked for this scalloped area on the surface that is typical of places where there's underground ice here on the Earth. So again, we used the Earth as a way of figuring out where to look on Mars. And then discovered that there's, in fact, this sheet of ice underneath. So now that doesn't mean that there's still existing life there, but it is possible. You know, we don't find like, you know, I don't know, ice crabs or anything like that.
Right.
But there's like algae and stuff that lives on ice here on the Earth. So maybe that's another habitat that we could look at.
Is Mars the most likely other planet to have life? Or is there another planet that you think that's a little bit more close to having life?
Well, Mars kind of has an advantage in that it's one of the easier places for us to study.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Mars and Venus are our two nearest neighbors. Mm-hmm. Mars is a little smaller than the Earth, and Venus is about the same size. The reason that you don't hear about Venus rovers is that Venus has this very thick atmosphere that makes it very hot on its surface. So when we've sent spacecraft to Venus, you know, it's more or less like taking your iPhone and putting it in a broiler. Like, it doesn't last very long, right? So we have some studies of Venus, but not a whole lot of, like, on-the-ground information. Now, Mars, on the other hand, is also close by to us, relatively speaking, and is a lot milder of an environment, so we could do things like send rovers to the surface. Some of the other places that we might look, like, that's kind of it for, like, the terrestrial planets, the small rocky planets in our solar system that might host life. But the larger, the like gas and ice giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn, their moons might potentially be a place to look for life. So a lot of people are really interested in studying life on Europa, which is this icy moon of Jupiter that has, we think, an under ice ocean. So it doesn't have an atmosphere, but it has this like ice cap that shows cracks in it and occasionally like geysers and stuff. So there might be ice life under there, or like aquatic life of some sort. Titan, which is a moon of Saturn, has always been a place that people have looked to as a potential place that might host life too.
But that's the day that everyone in your business, let's say everyone on Earth, is really looking forward to, when we have proof positive that there's life on another planet. That's going to be the biggest day, right?
Yeah, I think that'll be really huge.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's not just like a scientific thing, because, you know, if you think about the context of our life here on Earth in the greater universe, that's a very like human question.
Of course.
Are we alone in the universe?
Yeah.
And if we have an example of life that we can study that evolved on a different world, then that could maybe help us understand like how life arises.
Without question. And,
you know, but if you think practicality, it's time, it's money. You send all your experiments up there and astronauts just in search of life or in search of the new expeditions. And we've been waiting for so long. It's just, you know, you think about the opportunity. It takes a lot of time and effort and money. You know, in our brains, we're like, yes, tomorrow, let's do it.
We want it.
Yeah.
There's a great question online for you. Nancy's been holding on for a bit. Nancy, go ahead. I love this question.
Hi. You know, I was wondering what you thought of Stephen Hawking's proposal that for humanity to survive, we need to find another planet.
Stephen Hawking just said that sustainable life on this planet is going to come to an end a lot sooner than any of us were hoping to hear Stephen Hawking say. So that means we have to look out into the stars and find another place where humans could move to. What are your thoughts on that?
Right.
Well, first of all, you know, I think it's a good goal for us to try and live in other environments, other planets within the solar system. Going outside of our solar system is kind of prohibitively distant at
this point
with our current propulsion technologies. You know, we're not looking at human beings going and living on planets around another star anytime soon. And in order to do that with the technologies we have, you'd have to like live on what you would call a generation ship, like kind of like in WALL-E, where people just sort of live on this massive cruise ship that's in space, and you spend many generations traveling to another world. So certainly that's one possibility. But here in our own solar system, kind of the only environment that would be potentially amenable to us going and living there is someplace like Mars. You know, I take a little bit of issue with this, like, the idea that we need to, like, back up humanity, kind of like we're a hard drive or something on another world, just because, you know, if you think about what makes it possible for human beings or anybody really to think about going to another world, it's kind of the thing you do as a civilization after all of your creature comforts are met.
Yeah.
You have shelter, you have food, you have water, et cetera. And that means that the resources that we have here on this planet are very important to us, just in terms of our ability to have those creature comforts met and to have the resources to be able to go to other worlds.
Right.
So, you know, even if one day human beings live on Mars, Mars is never going to be as hospitable an environment as the Earth is.
Right.
And that's why it's important to preserve the Earth. You know, I'm all for us going and trying and living on other worlds, but we really have quite a gem here in our planet.
Right.
It's, you know, a place that we have a lot of resources for our survival, and that frees up our ability to do things that are really ambitious and that are not directly about survival like space.
No question. Nancy, great question. Thanks so much for participating. Have a good weekend. Sadly, we're out of time, but thank you for it's always a pleasure to have you on. We really appreciate that. Lucianne Walkowitz is an astrophysicist, like we said, at the Adler Planetarium. Adler's always doing great things. Do they have I know in the past they've done some special Christmas shows there. Is that the case this year as well? Do you know?
I'm not sure if we have any holiday shows on. We do still have our wonderful Planet Nine show that premiered this year. And we do have coming up also Illinois resident discount days. So there's quite a few of those happening in the near future. So I advise you to go to the website, adlerplanetarium.org, and look up Illinois resident discount days and free days. And those will take you through the holiday season.
Just good to get to Adler Planetarium.
Yeah,
it always
fascinating.
Is.
Come visit.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Lucianne. Appreciate it. We'll take a quick break, then more show. It's Bill and Jane in for Wendy on WGN.